The Percy family had owned this estate since William the Conqueror, or since any of the Plantagenet kings. So they're not going to sell any acreage. They're not going to sell Alnwick Castle, which is where Harry Potter was filmed, because they've owned that castle for 1,000 years.
Today's guest, Will Tanner, writer at American Tribune, reveals the hidden patterns of how old money families maintain wealth for generations and why Americans keep failing at it.
Oh, I like Bitcoin. I think it's really good as a store of value. I think the problem with it as a currency, you see under Trump a return of what you saw under McKinley, which is American prosperity. When capital gains and dividends are taxed at a lower rate than income, that makes it impossible to ever catch up with the wealthy. No matter how well you do, you just can't.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
What a day.
Yeah.
I'm going on 2 hours of sleep right now. I don't know about you.
Four.
I'm very happy. I mean, I didn't even think about it when we originally scheduled this, that it would be the day after the election. And even if I was cognizant, I think up until 10 p.m. Central last night, I was pretty sure it was going to take days, if not a week, to figure out the results. Mm-hmm. Of the election, but as it stands today, 1 p.m. Central, November 6, 2024, we have a clear winner. Donald Trump will be the 47th president of the United States. And I don't know about you, but I'm honestly shocked with how swift of a victory it was last night.
Yeah, I mean, I saw they called Michigan like an hour ago, and I thought that was going to be one of the states where like a month from now, they'd still be finding ballots in mailboxes or whatever. It's just shocking it happened so quickly. I really wasn't expecting that to go that way.
Neither was I. And so, I mean, I've been following you on Twitter, I think, for the better part of a year now. The work you're doing at the American Tribune and the ideas you have, particularly around Rhodesia and trying to make people aware that we should not allow the South Africanization of the United States to occur. And it seems like the election yesterday was this point, a fork in the road, if you will, where we could continue down overt, woke, socialist politics or sort of wipe the board clean or at least create the potential to wipe the board clean to go down a path built on meritocracy and in free markets. And so what do you think, based off of all the work that you've done and the topics that you focus on, the implications and the gravity of the decision that Americans made in the last 12 hours has on the future of this country?
Yeah, I think this was a much bigger decision than it would have been in 2020. That whole election was just a mess. But in the end, it might have been better that he lost, just because I think the past 4 years really put things in stark relief. Or even if you're not a particularly partisan person, which I think fewer of us are now than perhaps in the 90s, on one hand, you just have the race communism of South Africa. It's not particularly racial in its participants. There's all sorts of people on both sides, but just in the outlook of things. I mean, Kamala is really the standard bearer of that in the same way that Mandela or Mugabe were. But then on the other side, it's really interesting because you have people like Elon Musk. And I think that was one of the bigger stories of this election, was that Elon from South Africa grew up there, saw how everything turned out in that country. He pretty strongly took a stand just all of a sudden a couple months ago where he said, we're not doing this anymore. America isn't just drowning in this, he calls it equity, which is another correct word, a system of the sort Kamala wants. We're going to fight back and we're going to make it to Mars. And I really do think Mars is the best example of, you know, where things will go if you get the meritocratic capitalist system you're talking about. Because on one hand, or one side, you have the people who want the global favela, just everywhere, completely leveled, egalitarian, a mess. There's nothing good about it. There's no achievement. It's just squalor. But then on the other side, you have the opposite. You have hierarchy, which creates great things, as we've seen. I think the greatest thing it will do, in the near future is make it to Mars. And I think the American people pretty resoundingly in this election chose Mars over the favela.
Yeah. I mean, last night was an indictment not only of the incumbent policies or the policies of the incumbent administration and the trend that we've been going down. I mean, I would say for many decades, but really accelerated post-COVID with BLM riots and the bailouts and the handouts that have been given, PPP loans. And not only was last night an indictment of the incumbent administration, their policies, and where they want to take the country. It seems to be like a natural revulsion to that. But it's an indictment of the media, too, which tried to masquerade and put a facade on that widespread revulsion that many Americans have about these policies. And they tried to use their platforms to project that simply was not the case, and that people that had these natural revulsions are simply racist and are part of the patriarchy trying to hold back progress, if you will. And Trump getting back into office, I mean, as a Bitcoiner, somebody who focuses on Bitcoin, runs a fund investing in Bitcoin companies, from a regulatory perspective, the incoming Trump administration is way more favorable for my industry compared to Kamala's administration, which has attacked the banking industry that is supporting the Bitcoin industry. And the fact that the media has been completely delegitimized, I mean, the propaganda campaign that the American public has been subjected to for the better part of 150 days since Kamala was sort of placed in the position of candidacy. It was one of the strongest pushes ever, and last night's results showed that it had essentially no effect on public perception.
If anything, it was negative. I mean, I can't think of a mainstream media interview for either candidate that was positive. Kamala had a few that were just utter disasters. Trump had a few that didn't really matter, but it was really the alternative media that made a positive difference for candidates. Kamala was hammered for not going on Rogan. I'm interested in seeing exit polling and how many people's opinions changed because she didn't go on there. But then I think Rogan and Vance got a huge boost, not even because of what they said when they went on, but just because they went on and were able to have a 3-hour conversation. I think people were surprised that politicians could do that, just since, you know, everyone for the past couple decades has been so awful.
Well, J.D. Vance particularly, zoning in on some propaganda. I mean, he became the vice president candidate right after July 13th, right after the assassination attempt. And they came out with, like, oh, this guy's weird, and tried to, like, say that he was banging couches and stuff like that. And I think not only that interview, but many other interviews he's done, whether it's on All In or stump speeches, if you actually take the time to sit down and listen to him, he seems like a pretty sensible, articulate, smart individual. And the whole weird label that they tried to thrust on him completely fell flat, especially when you consider the vice president that Kamala picked with Tim Walz, who's objectively one of the weirder candidates I've seen on stage in my life.
Yeah, it wasn't brought up how Waltz's anniversary is the Tiananmen Square massacre. I think one media outlet reported on it, and he said it's because he wanted a day to remember, which they never followed up on. And, you know, that's objectively weirder than having a German Shepherd like Vance does, or just being otherwise. Vance just seems like a normal guy, even if they think his speech patterns are weird, which I don't think they are. But Waltz just has a lot of baggage, and so does Kamala. But of course, that was never brought up, which is another big indictment of the mainstream media.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you think we avoided, or are we in the process of avoiding, a color revolution that has been attempted on the American public for some time now?
Yeah, I think they more or less succeeded with one in 2020. If you look at what happened there, there were all the rioters for months. Trump wanted to call in the National Guard or Army. And there are a number of generals who behind the scenes just told Trump that the army wouldn't follow orders if he told them to put down the riots, which, I say what you will about the policy of sending in the National Guard, but I think when you have generals refusing to follow orders and then the media praising them for it as large revolts are happening across the big cities, that's more or less a color revolution. And I think with this, they're trying to solidify it because, you know, if people talk about the lion and fox dichotomy, where on one hand, you have people like Richard the Lionheart who are just able to influence things with their strength and vigor. But then nowadays, you have the foxes, the people who try and manipulate things behind the scenes and are averse to using force openly. And so they don't want to do that. And they wanted to solidify it by saying, you know, see, the American people back Kamala and equity and gay race communism, which they didn't. They voted against that. And I think that really put the brakes on the solidification of the color revolution and is going to start rolling it back because they don't want to use force to enforce it. And since they're not going to do that, if they can't manipulate things behind the scenes, it's just kind of over and unraveling.
Yeah. Is there something unique about Americans and American culture that enabled the stopping this color revolution to happen? Like, could it happen somewhere else? Or is there something unique to our identity in our culture that sort of was ignited in the bellies of American citizens that led to this decision?
Yeah, I think it's a weird thing because, you know, one advantage or weakness that Europe has over America or against America is that its countries are generally of one people, whether it's the Czechs or the Germans or the Poles. So if you get the ball rolling there, like they did in Ukraine with the color revolution there, it's pretty easy to kind of get things to pick up steam, because if the message strikes home with one person, it's probably going to strike home with the remaining 30 million or however many there are. Whereas in America, I mean, you have some English, you have some Scots-Irish, you have some actual Irish, and then just, you know, all the different people from Central Europe, Eastern Europe, Africa. So there is a great deal of ethnic diversity there, which has its pluses and minuses. But one of the pluses for this is there's not really a message that strikes home with that many people other than the blandest things or just generally positive things. Like, I think deregulation and low taxes tend to do pretty well with most groups. But, you know, overthrow your government and go riot in the streets and loot your local Macy's, you know, that doesn't really strike home with 70% of the population or whatever you need to get a big riot type thing going. Whereas with the Arab Spring, if it's in Syria and you're just getting Syrians going, you're just getting Egyptians going, that's a much different calculus and I think a good bit easier.
So, Freaks, this episode of TFTC is brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Do you have an old IRA or 401k that isn't keeping up with Bitcoin? Roll over into an Unchained Bitcoin IRA and take advantage of Bitcoin's long-term potential while enjoying tax-deferred growth. With Unchained, you hold real Bitcoin and keep control of your keys, reducing counterparty risk through their collaborative custody model, while Unchained handles the tax forms. It's very important. They handle the tax forms. Get started now with no setup fees and no account fee for the first year. Not only is this the only standard Bitcoin IRA where you can control keys, unlike other Bitcoin IRAs, you can take distributions directly in Bitcoin, avoiding exchange fees. Set up a Roth or traditional Bitcoin IRA for no charge today at unchained.com/TFTC and experience true ownership of your retirement savings. Go to unchained.com/TFTC. This rip is also brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. CoinKite builds the best Bitcoin hardware in the world. There is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. If you're looking to secure and self-custody your Bitcoin, you can get the MK4 or the Coldcard Q. Coldcard Q has a full keyboard, a QR scanner, NFC enabled, has a battery pack, put some AA batteries in there, create private public keys off pair in an air gap fashion. Private keys never have to touch an online device. They have their Sats card, which is the best way to give Bitcoin. If you're looking to gift Bitcoin for a wedding, a birthday party, a communion, a bar mitzvah, whatever it may be, tap the card on the back of your phone. You get a address to send to. You send it to that address. It lives on the Sats card. Again, there is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. The Bitcoin price seems to be going up. You want to take care of your security before Bitcoin goes to six figures. Make sure you get your Bitcoin off exchanges using CoinKite hardware. MK4, Cold Card Q. Go to CoinKite.com. Use the code TFTC. We have a code now, TFTC, for 5% off at checkout.
So where do you think we go from here? Like, what are the potential paths we have? Or maybe another way to frame it is where would you like to see us go from here? It seems like the administration is making some pretty quick moves. I don't think the votes are even done being counted. I just saw a tweet come across my tweet deck that Joel Salatin has been tapped on the shoulder to operate within the USDA. And so it seems like they're already moving to place people to make the systemic changes that they promised during their campaign.
Yeah, I think the first thing you're going to see is a repeat of Twitter, where if you remember, Elon bought it and everyone said, oh, this is going to fail. And then he just fired like 80% of the workforce and said, go home because you're awful. And they went home and they were awful. So now Twitter works as well or better as it did beforehand, but it, you know, 10% of the cost or some just, you know, obscene number because he got rid of all the dead weight. I think that's one of the first things you're going to see from them. He's putting Elon in charge of the Department of Government Efficiency. And they have people like Joel Salatin, who are used to being not part of the mainstream. Even if they're highly popular, they're not one of the big beef producers like JBL or Tyson or, you know, anything like that. He's a normal guy who just runs a ranch. So I think what you're going to see is a cutting out of a lot of the deadwood of centralization, or at least that's what I'd like to see. And then you'll see people who are competent do the things that need to be done well. So instead of having the Pentagon flail around in the Middle East for two decades and lose, you'll have Eric Prince do it in a year and do it well, and then either remain and make it a profitable venture or just get out if you need to stay or need to get out, depending. It's hard to predict what exactly will happen because you never know what wars are going to break out or, you know, what economic condition is going to present itself. But I think generally what you'll see is the people of that mold who are quite competent people start to take over some things and get rid of the dead wood under them because they don't need large bureaucracies to get done what they want to get done.
Yeah, it would be good to see competent people in positions of power dictating policy and helping to cut costs.
If NASA could do space things instead of just putting rainbow flags outside its buildings, that'd be cool.
Do you have the sense, like I have the sense now and have had even in the lead up to the election yesterday, is like there's got to be a moment where we get rug pulled. Like, do you think is this going to affect actual change, or are we getting our hopes up? Because that's one thing I was a long time staunch, many would define as a libertarian. It was like, I'm not going to vote. Voting doesn't make a decision. But this year, I have two young children now, and I think becoming a father and looking out at the world and trying to project what it will be like when they grow up has really forced me to look internally and think about the decisions of how I'm affecting change in the world that they're growing up in. And I felt compelled to go out and voice my opinion with a vote yesterday in support of Trump and the sort of vision of the future that he and the team he assembled represents. But that libertarian in the back of my mind is like, did I just vote and for an eventual rug pull?
You know, I think if he had won in 2020, that would have just been another rug pull. And that's, if you look at the people around him, then it's all people. There was no one in his administration who didn't try and stab him in the back, other than maybe Steve Bannon. But Bannon was also just an attention hound who wasn't really doing much. Whereas now, if you look at the people who've surrounded Trump, it's no longer the old RNC establishment, people like Rince Priebus. It's instead Elon, Vivek, Vance, Thiel, Eric Prince, which is a really different set of people. And I think the difference there is that not only are they competent and can get things done as opposed to just having been political apparatchiks all their lives, but they also have a vision of things they want to achieve. Like Elon wants to get to Mars and cut the deadwood to get there. I think Vance kind of wants to restore the old 1980s America. We'll see how successful he's in that. And Prince really wants a decentralized government with a lot of privatized arms that do interesting things and have the power to do interesting things abroad. So how well it will turn out, I think well, but we'll see. But I do think they'll actually achieve things this time rather than it just be a continual mess that only results in tax cuts for corporations that donate to Democrats.
Yeah, and I think that's why I was drawn to the message and the vision put forth by this coalition. Mm-hmm. Like leaning into MAHA specifically, like Make America Healthy Again. Like that's not something you do overnight. I think RFK and everybody pushing the MAHA movement has this recognition that this isn't going to be something that happens overnight. Like if you're going to fix the health of an entire nation, it's going to take time. And so there's this inherent lowering of time preference that comes along with a goal like Make America Healthy Again. And that is what I've been focused on in Bitcoin for over a decade now, is I believe we need sound money in the digital age so that we can allocate capital appropriately and have a money that actually stores value over time so that we can lower our time preference and aim to achieve harder goals that take more time and inevitably lead to a higher quality of life, higher quality goods, higher quality services for individuals in the long term.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, one thing that adds credibility is when the people pushing something obviously live it out themselves. And Kennedy, for whatever his earlier drug problems, is now a very healthy person for how old he is. And he still does, like, he has that funny video where he's doing the bench press in jeans or whatever, and he's out on the beach and it's like a sunny day and he looks good. So he's just a healthy person. He's a normal guy that lifts weights. And, you know, opposed to whoever would be running the government health bureaucracy in past years, like the Belgian health minister meme, he actually is healthy, so it makes sense that he'd make America healthy again.
Rachel Levine, the other like going back to like American culture, like was this just, and even though the propaganda was strong, but did it get to a point where it was just so, again, repulsive, literally ugly, at Rachel Levine as the head of Department of Health, who is a literal man pretending to be a woman, it does not look healthy at all. That is the image of the person that is controlling the healthcare system in America. And it's like, it almost feels like there's just like, I mean, everybody says vibe shift, but just this, like many people independently came to the conclusion without even articulating it. Many people were articulating it publicly, but I think many people in the silent majority were just in their heads like, this has gotten so insane, so ugly. Mm-hmm. We need a vision of strength and beauty and vitality that we can move towards. And that's obviously become a big subculture on Twitter over the last years, is this vitality movement, anti-seed oils, right. Sun steel, sun your balls, all that stuff.
Yeah. You know, one thing, like ever since World War II, the buildings have been getting uglier and uglier. The guy who wrote James Bond, Ian Fleming, famously made the bad guy named Goldfinger because Erno Goldfinger was a brutalist architect who was making London ugly. And Fleming hated it so much that he made the bad guy named after him. And it's only gotten worse since then. But around the 2000s, maybe, or late 90s, the people started getting ugly as well on like a large scale, whether that was because of seed oils or lithium in the water, or atrazine and glyphosate. I have no idea. But they did. And I think that's when it just came in and it kind of hit critical mass with the like lockdowns of 2020, where all these people who aren't healthy at all are telling you you're not allowed to have a social life or go out to bars and have to wear masks because they're scared for their health. And I think people just couldn't do it anymore. It's too much. The buildings are ugly. The people are ugly. The people wear just awful clothes, Marvel t-shirts instead of suits or blazers. Yeah, it's just an ugly world we live in now, and I think people really hate it. And Trump and Kennedy and the others really stand against that. Trump always dresses like a successful businessman. He had that executive order where all federal buildings had to be designed in the neoclassical style. Vance dresses pretty well and lost some weight and grew a nice beard. RFK, like I said, lifts weights and is a pretty healthy guy. It's a very different movement, and like you said, it's a vitalist one. And I think the idea of beauty is important. I think also, have you heard the term bio-Leninism?
Yes.
Yeah. I think Spandrel coining that term and just promulgating it helped people put their finger on it and just describe what's going on in a way that was very helpful. Because it sounds bad to be like, oh, everyone in the government's fat, which is true, but not particularly helpful. Whereas to say, yeah, we're operating on a pretty bio-Leninist system. I think that is a more accurate descriptor and people are a little bit more comfortable saying it.
Well, that, I mean, because not only is it like visually ugly and physically ugly, but the ideas are ugly as well. Mm-hmm. Going back to equity and communism, the divisive nature of the politics of the left recently is there's a boogeyman. They're taking money from you. They're taking opportunity from you. We need to level the playing field and basically prevent people from succeeding. And the world is shit. It's because of these people who have success. And it's just not a good, it's an ugly mental framework from which to operate and to sort of plant that mental framework into the minds of the masses, which has been done pretty successfully by the mainstream media apparatus over the course of the last 3 decades.
Yeah, it has. And it's a weird thing because you asked earlier if there's some resistance America has to these color revolutions. I think one thing it does have or used to have a resistance to is any form of socialism. Eugene Debs was never pretty popular. FDR cloaked his socialist reforms in the guise of being patriotic. Yeah, we've had an ownership culture, not a socialist one. And I just think that kind of changes this sort of thing around, where they've tried to push these messages, but because people own their houses, own their cars, Jet used to have kids, there's just a little bit more resistance to these things where, like you said, these ideas are ugly. And I think people are a little bit easier able to say, this is awful. This is just an ugly idea and really, really bad, because they don't want to see their house taken away to house some migrant family, or, you know, whatever the socialist policy would be. That I think England was temporarily doing that, and they just don't want that here.
Yeah, I mean, that's a thread you wrote today. Yeah. About how do we, what are the low hanging fruits that this administration can go over or go after without with relative ease, in terms of having to get through red tape and push things through the House and the Senate. And immigration is one of those. And that has obviously been one of the bigger topics leading up to the election last night, was immigration, to diametrically opposed views of what to do. One, open borders, let everybody in. The other, we're going to close the borders and we're actually going to send some of them back. And the sending back part is, or was, used by the media as a boogeyman of, I mean, you mentioned it in your thread, the inciting visions of rounding people up, putting them on buses and sending them back. But I think your thread was pretty insightful in the sense that it highlighted just some very low hanging fruit economic policies that you could institute, or regulations they can institute, in terms of verifying whether or not a worker is actually an American citizen. That could lead to people self-deporting themselves.
Yeah, it's one of these things where a lot of people want something to happen, but then have not really ever thought through how they get there. The illegal immigration thing is the big example, because pretty consistently when polled, Americans say they don't really want illegal immigrants either here or getting into the country, which is probably true. They don't want them here. But then as soon as anyone tries to fix that, the media just conjures up, like you said, images of train cars and camps, which no one wants either, even though that's never what's happening. So you have to look at ways to get these people to self-deport and just decide that it's much better off for them to be in Guatemala or Honduras or Haiti or wherever instead of America, which I understand that Haiti's a pretty tough sell, but the others I think you could get through. And so it's, you can cut off their access to welfare programs, which most people don't know, but illegal immigrants can access a large slew of the welfare programs, particularly if they birth a child on American soil, who's then counted as an American citizen. A lot of the health and welfare style stuff they're then eligible for. Similarly, you can pass E-Verify and make it mandatory across the states for any hiring whatsoever, whether it's a contractor, an employee, temporary position. You can just force them to do it, and pair that with stiff penalties for employers, where then it's never worth it for an employer to hire these people. So at the point where they can't access welfare and can't access a job, they pretty much have to leave. You can also tax remittance payments, which really gets rid of the reason for being here, because a lot of the money is sent out on net basis, about $150 billion a year. So you couldn't tax the Bitcoin transactions if they ever figured that out, but generally they just use Western Union, so it'd be pretty easy to tax. So there are just a few things you could do that would be very simple, probably wouldn't even require congressional approval or congressional lawmaking. E-Verify would maybe be the one that did, but the others you could just do anyway. And it would just get people to self-deport, where there's no train cars, there's no buses. It's just people leaving, and the problem kind of solves itself. And I think it'd be helpful for a wage growth. It would be a spur to wage growth, because there'd no longer be the depressant of, it's probably around 30 million people here illegally right now, as best I'm able to tell. And it would also reduce the cost of housing, which is a major issue for Americans right now, because there are 30 million people that don't need housing anymore.
I mean, it's close to 10% of the population, which is material. It's probably between 7 and 8%. That's nothing to scoff at, that it has a material effect on the economics of individual citizens. And I think the housing cost, because that was the big worry. And Jerome Powell said this explicitly a few months ago. I don't think he should have said it, but he essentially admitted, we've been letting these illegal immigrants come in because it leads to lower wage growth, which tapers inflation a bit. And I guess that's the big worry from an economic perspective is if you have the illegal immigrant workforce population moving back to their homes and wage growth is allowed to naturally rise as Americans overtake those jobs, how do you counteract that? And I think you made a very good point in the thread is that if you have tens of millions of people leaving areas where they're renting houses or buying houses, that's gonna lead to lower cost of housing, which should negate that rise in wages from an inflationary perspective.
Right. And one issue with the inflation argument, which I totally see what they're saying there, it's accurate in some respects, is like the problem with inflation is generally that you're then able to buy fewer things on your salary, which makes sense, of course. But for salaried people where their wages are going up, I think generally wages would rise faster than the cost of most goods. And even then, particularly over the long term, I think that would happen. And also what you get is when more people are working and more is being produced and less money is being remitted, there's just a lot more money flowing into the economy, whether it's savings or consumer purchases, that I think would be a spur to real economic growth as opposed to what we have now, where a lot of people are either on a government check or working some sort of service job as illegal immigrants do the things in the real world economy, whether it's meatpacking or house building or whatever. I just think you need some of these spurs to get back to the real world and real world goods and real world economy. We can't just all sell each other like Substack subscriptions and hotel reservations. Someone has to do something in the real world. And I think it'd be much better if it was American citizens making a living wage as opposed to something approaching slave labor that's just brought in and abused from various places abroad that should have those people there working hard and making those countries better so they're a more pleasant place to live.
This RIP was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off. This RIP was also brought to you by our good friends at Salt of the Earth. You got to be hydrating, freaks. And while you're hydrating, you got to be getting your electrolytes. This is the best electrolytes mix that I've ever come into contact with. Pink Himalayan salt with calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, no sugar. It tastes incredible. My favorite is the orange and the pink lemonade. Go to drinksote.com. That's drinksote.com. Use the code TFTC when you make your purchase and you'll get 15% off. I'm telling you, get on it, freaks. You're going to love this stuff.
That's another, when it comes to the immigration discussion, like a lot of people are like, oh, they can't go back to their country. The country's terrible. And it's like, well, we have, I think El Salvador is a perfect example where you had Bukele come in a few years ago and now they have reversed diaspora. People are going back to El Salvador because Bukele has given individual Salvadoran citizens the confidence to go back because he created a stable environment. Crime is down, went from the most dangerous to the safest country in the world in a very short period of time. They have very lax economic policy that is trying to spur growth and job creation within the borders of El Salvador. And that is a perfect model. It's like we should be going to every other country and say, do what El Salvador is doing and create a safe environment and a tax environment where people actually want to grow the economy, create jobs, and it creates an environment where people don't want to leave and feel compelled to go to America to work and send money back home.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a really good book called El Norte or Bust. I forget the author's name, but he describes the debt bubble that ensues when a large number of people are going to the United States from one of these communities and how it just ends in disaster. I think his focus was on the 08 recession and how it just eviscerated. Do you remember what country they're from? Bolivia or somewhere?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And yeah, just a total wreck, which none of it needed to happen. They could have just stayed there and focused on building a business there if the policies were right. DeSoto, I think, wrote a book about property rights in South America and how you could tweak some things to make it better. I forget the book's name now, but there's just, you know, like you could make policy tweaks in America to solve the illegal immigration problem. I think you could make some pretty easy policy tweaks in some of these Central and South American countries to spur business. And, you know, one of the problems with mass democracy is it really has a hard time looking at the day after tomorrow. It has trouble making these long-term investments in a way that the pre-reform, or at least pre-1914 or so, 1911, aristocratic governments didn't. I think with Bukele and Milei and Orban, and I think it's Liechtenstein that's ruled by its king again because they just got tired of democratic squabbling. You're seeing a return to some of this long-term thinking where Bukele says, you know, yes, it's going to be painful for a month as we lock up these MS-13 gangsters. But on the other hand, they behead people and they worship Satan. And it's going to really be a spur to every good aspect of El Salvador if we lock them up. So maybe we should spend the $20 million or whatever it was to build a large prison and just lock them up instead of having to deal with just these continual problems of trying to lessen the just present amount of pain you're feeling. So I think El Salvador is really seeing that, which is great. Some of these other countries, you could probably spur them into it. The big problem is you need to get America to start thinking that way, which perhaps Elon, Thiel, Prince, that crowd will be able to. But I think that's going to be one of the big challenges for the Trump administration is you need this change mindset that is willing to do long-term investment, because that's what built America in the Gilded Age, is people like Carnegie willing to invest large sums of money in the real world, which you haven't gotten since, I don't know, the 50s or 60s. And it's starting to bite. So we need that again. And how they get there is, I think, going to be one of the big problems or one big challenge for them to focus on.
What do you think in regards of, as it pertains to having these long-term oriented goals that require big upfront investments, like what are some of the areas you think we need those most pressingly right now?
Material science is a big one. If you look at like Gulfstream jets, they used to make pretty big advances. And since it's a private market for very wealthy people, you can just expect them to produce the best thing. I think there was the transition from the 5 to the 6. They spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to make it more fuel efficient, longer range, all that. They made marginal changes at best. There wasn't really anything they could do. And the problem was that material sciences hadn't advanced whatsoever, so they couldn't do anything. So it's this corporate R&D, just long-term investment inside corporations like Bell Labs used to do, or like Edison was known for doing. You need to bring that back. And I think that's one of the big examples would be material science, where you can do that. I think also the shift away from software as a service companies, maybe with the exception of Palantir, back into hard tech, whether it's what's that defense startup that's doing well? I always forget its name. But
Anduril.
Yeah, Anduril or Hadrian, which is doing the same thing with machine tooling, I believe. And small nuclear reactors or small modular reactors for nuclear plants. I think that sort of thing where it's somewhat new and has a tech flavor, so it gets people excited, even though it's really just an iteration of some pretty old technology. I think that'd be pretty cool. It's going to require a lot of capital investment and a lot of kind of long-term just money pits, but I think it'll prove profitable in the end. And I think also it'll be large enough steps forward that people are comfortable or get more comfortable with pouring money into something. I think also, though, like you mentioned, you'd need something approaching a harder money, at least compared to other world currencies, to get people to do that, because otherwise it's always just going to be the constant grind against perceived inflation, which...
Yeah. I mean, that's... I was just going to highlight Boeing as a perfect example. Like the combination of ESG, DEI, and the perverse incentives that have been introduced in the market via money printing and debt expansion, which is Boeing had essentially the triple threat of adopting all three as they fired the engineers in the C-suite and brought in McKinsey consultants who had never built anything in their lives. And they just became beholden to quarterly financials and stock price appreciation at all cost. And so instead of investing their cash balances in long-term R&D that would produce better products, aerospace products, decade on decade, they instead took that cash, bought their stock back to lower the denominator of their floating share price so that the stock price would go up and they'd be able to get the bonuses. And that has resulted in planes literally falling out of the sky and astronauts getting stuck in space. It's like a perfect microcosm of the lack of long-term investment incited by easy money and perverse incentives because of the monetary system leading to terrible outcomes.
Yeah, it's one of these weird things that starts happening with easy money. Corporations, of course, behaved badly on the gold standard. There's credit mobilier and the railroads and all that. It was a different type of behaving badly, though, because they still actually built railroads that did things. You know, you can screw around with the financials of a steel plant, but if it's still producing steel, then it doesn't really matter that much, which they had to do. It had to produce something. Whereas now, there's so many of these tech companies. At Boeing, the planes no longer work, which is horrible. But think how many software companies have never made a profit, never will, and they've just been evaporating this easy money because periodically it'll spike and they can sell it. It's a big problem. And it also shows, there's something about the current iteration of mass democracy where the institutions under it will just start wearing the skin suits of their former selves for a completely different purpose. Public companies are a great example of that. I mean, public companies used to really produce what American wealth in the real economy and do things, whether it was the railroads or the shipping companies, just, you know, the things you think of when you think of the Gilded Age: railroads, steamships, steel plants, coal mines. They had their issues, but they did stuff. Whereas now, public companies pretty much exist solely to push DEI on their workforces and like host dystopian pizza parties for the remaining employees. It's really weird. And Boeing's just the perfect example, where it's this company that should be a prime American company and probably would be if it was a private company like SpaceX. But instead, they're just dedicated to quarterly financials. So they do absolutely nothing except try and appease the ESG people and, yeah, like you said, buy their shares back to fiddle with the financials. It's a mess. The whole skin suit thing is one of the bigger problems, and that's another thing we're going to have to get past. But I think for that, it's just private companies are probably a lot better at it.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin?
Oh, I like Bitcoin. I think it's really good as a store of value. I think the problem with it as a currency is if you look at the late 19th century with William Jennings Bryan and the silver movement, when the gold supply hadn't expanded for a while, because this was post 49ers, but pre the gold mines in the Rand in Australia, people were getting pretty fed up with how tight money was. It might have been good for them, but it created an unstable political environment, and the constant depreciation in goods prices, particularly agricultural goods, it caused a lot of problems for the farmers and for the parts of the economy related to that. So I think, you know, being able to save your money and store wealth, which Bitcoin enables in a way that, you know, ETFs and publicly traded shares don't, is a great thing. I think the problem, though, is for currencies and really a society in which debt is involved. You don't need inflation, but deflation is a serious problem just because it makes debt so expensive and somewhat unpredictably expensive if prices fall at an increasing rate. So I think that's the hurdle you'd have to get past. I don't really know enough about economics to solve that. I wish I could, but William Jennings Bryan really didn't win only because the Rand mines were opened up and just produced a large amount of gold that released the social tension and solved the issue, which I think is a similar problem you'd get to if Bitcoin actually became a currency people used and debt was denominated in.
Yeah, that's the... particularly while Bitcoin's monetizing, like if you're going to go into Bitcoin-denominated debt, it's at a $1.5 trillion market cap now. Many people think we'll get a multi-hundred-trillion-dollar market cap at some point in the future, and it'll be extremely liquid market, most liquid market on the planet. But yeah, if you're going to take out Bitcoin-denominated debt now and try to pay that back as Bitcoin's monetizing between now and that multi-hundred-trillion-dollar market cap, it would be insane. And I guess that's one of the ideas that Bitcoiners definitely recognize that. And I think, or not Bitcoiners, there's many Bitcoiners focus on the economic impact of Bitcoin as a monetary good in the economy that have thought about this. And I guess that's a big question. Like, will debt just be limited to a certain level and you'll basically be engaged in equity-based economy where people investing in companies, or if you're going to give money to somebody, you're essentially getting equity in that project and getting dividends on that versus issuing debt to get paid back in the future.
Yeah, the whether it's dividends or interest on debt, I think the problem is that even though as a society we've largely moved to capital gains as a marker of success rather than the income generated by the capital, which for a long time, for British estates, for example, if you ever read Pride and Prejudice or see the movie, people are treated in terms of like the value of their estate, but the value is the income generated by it. So £10,000, which would now be like $300,000, $500,000 in income, was a large amount, obviously, but that wasn't the capital value of the land. That was the income generated by it. And I think you still need that because people don't really like selling assets to fund lifestyle, because that just introduces the whole creep of, well, I can sell one more share or one more bond and it won't be a big issue, but then soon enough, they're all gone. Whereas if there's income sustainably generated by it, it's a much better situation because it lasts indefinitely and you never have to sell the asset and you're not tempted to sell the asset. So I think that's another just problem for Bitcoin is I really like it as a saving mechanism for wealth. But when there's no income generated by it, you can never rely on it to live on unless you're planning on selling it, which if it's going up in value, seems like a bad decision. The income issue and the deflation issue, I think, turn into issues where once it's monetized fully and things are settled, it's not so much a problem. But as it's going up, it's just hard to generate income on something like that that doesn't involve selling the asset.
Yeah, that's a big theory or thesis that many Bitcoiners have. I mean, going back to government waste of Boeing, the dystopian pizza parties that are just wasting money. That is available because of the way in which the fiat monetary system works. I mean, just look at the federal government. We had our jobs report last week, came in well under expectations, expected 100,000 jobs, 12 jobs were added to the economy. And if you took out government jobs, it would have been negative 63,000 jobs and were lost, or 63,000 jobs were lost last month. And I think highlighting the fact that government jobs are the leading cause of job growth in recent months and recent years, I mean, that is literal waste as people aren't doing anything productive. And that's the idea. And one of the theses is that if you bring back sound money, people will just be forced to go out and be productive throughout the economy. And so obviously not produce an income via Bitcoin, the asset itself, but go use Bitcoin and capital accumulation to start a business or figure out how to get an income stream by selling goods and services that funds a lifestyle that hopefully allows you to build a bit bigger Bitcoin stack over time.
Yeah, we'll see. I just, a lot of people, I think, work hard with the idea of being able to retire, whether that's the conventional retirement in the 60s or kind of the new thing is trying to work hard enough to be able to do it just when you want to do it, when you're financially free. I think it's hard to be financially free really ever on a non-income producing asset because you're going to have to sell it, which you never know how that's going to turn out. The whole dividends issue or interest issue, I think, is an interesting one just because whether or not it's good or bad is a separate issue. But as a matter of just psychology of successful people, I think people like being able to rely on something that's coming in rather than involves clicking the sell button.
Yeah, I agree there. I mean, and we're getting into sort of the nitty gritty of the topic why I originally reached out to have you on the show, which is this idea of like wealth accumulation and passing along through generations. And that is something that many Bitcoiners have thinking about, myself personally thinking about as I'm building this business, the venture fund, and watching Bitcoin go up in price and it's an art and a practice that I think has been lost throughout time, particularly as fiat money has corrupted things. And we have this ugly society where the inheritors of wealth don't have the correct mindset to actually steward grow and pass that wealth down through multiple generations into the future. And you sent me a paper, and it was just really interesting to see how wealth accumulation and the passing down of that wealth has evolved over time, and the factors that have really perturbed the ability for individuals to do that and families to do that over time.
Yeah. It just is a little bit of background, because it's a very odd specific subject. I just finished up law school in May, and the last little bit of law school is really boring because you're not doing much. So I was just, since I still had a school account, I was poking around on JSTOR trying to figure out if there are any papers on what the old families in England that have survived put their money in. Because it is, I think, an interesting subject of how, say, the Percy family has been powerful in England for 1,000 years and remained that way. The Grosvenor family, similarly, or the Manners family, they all came across with William the Conqueror in 1066 or 67 with the Percys. And they're still wealthy, which is interesting. And if you look at this paper, I think it's called Trajectories of Aristocratic Wealth. What you find is that the only families really in England who survived the death tax regime of the 19th century, which was introduced in a large way by Lloyd George and Winston Churchill in the 1909 People's Budget, and then became a big issue with the Parliament Bill of 1911, which took away the power of the House of Lords to veto any legislation. Then World War I, World War II, things got expensive. So death taxes shot up to, in the 60s, it was 90% under Harold Wilson. So when you died, 90% of the estate would just be confiscated. That really destroyed a lot of families. But if you look at the ones who survived, the Percys, the Grosvenors, the Marquesses of Bute, it wasn't the ones who had been created as peers by Edward VII or Queen Victoria. Those families died out within a generation or two. They just spent all the money. It was gone near immediately. However, a certain number of families did survive, and they were the ones who might have been considered, except for the Grosvenors, kind of poor in the late 1800s, early 1900s, because they mainly owned land rather than stocks or bonds. But what that did is it encouraged them to never sell, because if you have an estate of 100,000 acres, really it's only valuable and maybe 10,000 acre blocks, but it's hard to sell 300 acres because the legal costs just mount, or you don't get anything out of it, particularly with the capital gains tax. So they never sold, they just held on to it. And now, because land has shot up in value, with, I think, a problem is land being somewhat monetized as an asset, it just makes farming too expensive, but ignoring all that, they have gotten wealthy and they still have income streams from the land. So these families still kind of act like noble families. A good example is the Marquesses of Salisbury. Lord Salisbury was famously the prime minister for Queen Victoria. His great-grandson, I think, the current Lord Salisbury, is still the leader of the House of Lords, or at least was until recently, and is one of the more conservative right-wing members of the Lords. So it's interesting. They survived, and they're still wealthy, and they're still acting like aristocrats rather than having to scrounge around for work doing, yeah, whatever. So if you look at why they survived when the others failed, it's really because they had an asset that they had a reason to hold on to and was difficult to sell. So while others could just sell stock and a business that was once the family business, but they had no attachment to, the Percy family had owned this estate since William the Conqueror or since any of the Plantagenet kings. So they're not going to sell any acreage. They're not going to sell Alnwick Castle, which is where Harry Potter was filmed, because they've owned that castle for 1,000 years or probably closer to 700. So they're going to stay. They're going to figure out a way to make it work. And they're going to have some degree of family continuity and historical continuity with the land that encourages them to work hard to make it work as a thing, which takes a lot of money. The Duchess of Rutland was talking about Beaver Castle, where they live. Every year, it costs $500,000 just to keep the lights on, probably more now with the cost of energy. So that, you know, that takes a lot of kind of figuring things out, particularly with the high taxes they have there. But they did it, and they succeeded, and they overcame the death taxes. And I think the reason is this just idea of purpose and continuity, and the idea that selling is probably a bad idea because you're never going to get it back. So you need to find a way to make it work without doing that. So it's an interesting paper, and they succeeded in it, which I think is, it's very long-winded, and I've been talking, but Americans are really bad about that. Americans always sell stuff. My great-great grandparents were in New York in the Gilded Age and were in the New York 400, lost everything in the Depression because they just sold it and spent it. Now I'm working, so annoyed. But it was a joke. But Americans are bad about that in the way that the British aren't. So I think now that people are making a lot of money, Bitcoin is just a great example because it's the sudden wealth that really people accumulated, particularly if they've been holding for a while now. And so the question is, like, how do you act once you do that? In addition to noblesse oblige, which is, I think, a related but somewhat different subject, there's this idea of family purpose and family continuity and connection with the past that they were able to build these landed families. So the question is, how do you build that as an American? Because it seems to have worked for them in fighting a pretty tyrannical socialist government.
Yeah. No, as an Irish American with a pretty strong Irish Catholic family from the Northeast. I'm from Philadelphia originally, and that's my mom was one of eight. I've got dozens of cousins, and we're like brothers and sisters. And that's one thing I hold near and dear to my heart is every summer we all get together down the shore, and we have this sort of culture within our family of you always go to the shore in the summer, you hang out. And now we're at the point where between myself, my cousins, we have, I think, 20 kids under the age of 10, and they're growing up the same way that we did. And that's something I think about a lot is, like, how do we continue that? And being successful and having a certain amount of wealth probably is necessary. And that's the other thing. I can't remember if it was you or another paper I was reading, but sort of whether it's the aristocracy or aristocracy, excuse me, or I'm on 4 hours of sleep right now, so excuse me, or just like wealthy families in general, like what they should strive to do. Like, you get wealth, and I believe it was you or another, or maybe it was somebody who was on your podcast recently.
It was probably Johann Kurtz. He talks about this a bit.
Talking about like founding fathers and how they were able to strive for higher goals because they had the wealth of the land and their family wealth that had been accumulated over the course of many generations, and they were able to go seek out those higher purposes, starting the revolution, being statesmen, being diplomats, if you will, and or investing in city parks and in monuments. And once you accumulate that wealth, it's like, how do you not only preserve it, but then once you're able to preserve it, what do you do? What do you strive for?
Yeah, it's I think Stormy Waters might be the person you're thinking of. He's talked about this a good bit with the Gilded Age American aristocracy. One thing Americans also do differently is split up the wealth when they die and pass it on, whereas the British pass it in one entity, whether it's to a trust or a person through primogeniture isn't a law anymore, but they still more or less act on that principle. And what that does is if you're avoiding the taxes, which they try to do through dynasty trusts, the money never gets split up. So there ends up being a large degree of income off it, whether it's land or stocks or whatever it ends up being. And a point that Randolph Churchill, the son of Winston Churchill, makes in his biography of his father is that Winston was really only able to do what he did as a politician and writer because of the support granted him by his cousin, the Duke of Marlborough. As Randolph puts it, the benefit of primogeniture is that impoverished cadet branches can always reach out to their cousins for help. Or it's a funny line like that, which Winston was shameless in doing just constantly. But it really is a benefit because the money's never split up, it creates a surplus that can be used for better ends, whether that's helping family or yourself serving in the government without drawing a salary or whatever random thing it is, whether it's military service, political service, helping your family, helping your community. A large amount of money is a great thing. Joking. But the income and wealth, I think, generated by one large pot rather than a diffused kind of spread out thing amongst people who don't really know or care why they have it, ends up creating better outcomes. Because Carnegie, for example, built pretty much all the libraries in America, or at least all the pretty ones, the brutalist ones he's not responsible for, but the pretty ones he is. And he only did that because he had a huge amount of money from selling American steel, and he thought that'd be a good thing to do. Or Rockefeller did a similar thing with churches. They're just examples like that of these men who were able to do that. Whereas if you think about the money, if they'd been operating on whatever it's called now, where the employees insist that the owners of the company should make them shareholders just for existing, you're never going to get that because they don't care. They'll just spend it on another truck or whatever, which might be good for them because, you know, I like my truck. But you're not going to get the societal benefits from a diffused thing that there's no real attachment or connection to that you do from having purpose and creating something and using it towards an end rather than just for mere existence. And that's a problem with many of our modern oligarchs and plutocrats is, you know, Bill Gates doesn't really
care. I was just going to ask, how would you dissect Bill Gates and what he's done with his wealth?
Yeah, it's the problem. Philanthropy is really what like Bill Gates and Buffett do. Where I'm sure they're good guys in some respects, but there's never a connection if you're, say, sending like $100 million to Africa to buy mosquito nets or whatever what's the altruist thing? Effective altruism.
Mm-hmm.
They always talk about mosquito nets. The problem is the natives ended up just using mosquito nets to overfish the waters. Yeah. So it killed off all the fish. Now they're starving again. It's a huge problem. And if you look at why that happened, it's not just because it's the stupid idea that they spent too much money on. It's also that there's never an actual connection to the locality in which the money was being spent and the person who was spending it. So Bill Gates, this is just a tax write-off for him in some positive press because he used to be known as just the worst of worst plutocrats. And now he's the philanthropist, but he doesn't have a connection to the village in Nigeria where they're buying mosquito nets. So he doesn't really care what's happening. Whereas if he was, say, an English lord in 1850 and was, like Lord Russell was known to do, spending a great amount of money building better housing for his workers or agricultural workers, he'd really care how the houses turned out because it reflected poorly on him if they were bad and well on him if they did well. It actually mattered both to the people in the community and whoever found out about it. Whereas Bill Gates is detached enough from his philanthropy that it doesn't matter. It's not... And not only is it not his locality, it's not his people, it's not his community. He's just detached from it and it doesn't matter to him other than that theoretically something good happened. So I think that's really the problem with modern philanthropy and the plutocrats who are known for their philanthropic adventures. They're not really doing good, even if some of the things they do turn out well, because there's no purpose to it. It's not community building. It's not people building. It's just a spending of money for a tax write-off at the end of the day.
Yeah, what do you think drives that? Just a natural disconnection from community that has proliferated in recent times, or a recognition of we need to figure out our tax strategy, and this is the easiest thing to do, or a combination of the two maybe?
Yeah, I think it's a long-term thing that particularly Anglo societies are known for. There's a famous line in Dickens, a telescopic philanthropy, where there's some woman who's at a church and all her children are starving and all the children around her are starving. But she's going on and on about like the poor natives in Sumatra or you know wherever, halfway around the world. And Dickens' point was, well, maybe you should get a shirt for your like freezing to death boy because that should be a bigger deal to you than that theoretically natives in Sumatra might be better off if they had British tea or you know, whatever it is. I forget the story. It's some ridiculous example. But so that I think the impulse for philanthropy, a world away where you don't have to deal with the consequences or implementation has really been this weird aspect of wealth building in the Anglo world for a while. I think the impulse to do it on a massive scale is partly tax policy, but then partly also just the liquid nature of the way wealth is built in modernity. It used to be like Bill Gates, if he'd built Microsoft in 1870, would have sold it and invested it in an estate and become a member of the landed gentry in Shropshire, and then focused on doing stuff in the village with the remaining wealth, which is just a different mindset and leads to different things than Microsoft stock is highly liquid. He could sell however many shares he wants tomorrow. He'd have to organize it with JP Morgan if it was a large block of shares, but could still do it. It just creates different impulses. And I think you see these things play out. The bad habits of yesteryear still exist, and they're just on a much grander scale now.
Yeah. So I guess what you're getting at is like you need to invest a good portion of your wealth into somewhat illiquid assets that force you to become grounded and connected to those assets and the locality in which they exist.
Yeah, whether it has to be in the physical world, I think, is a question. For example, my think I have a Trezor ledger, whatever it's called. I got it a while ago, like I said, before I was asleep, for Bitcoin. And I put, when I had like a full Bitcoin, I put it on the thing and said, well, I'll just keep that on there and never touch it. That's a very different impulse than when it's just in your Coinbase account or whatever. And you can say, well, I want to sell it, or I want to take out debt based on this Bitcoin, which is probably a horrible idea, et cetera, et cetera. But you can do it, and the impulses do it because the, you know, button is there. You can do it if you want. Whereas if it's on a thing where there's just even any friction between the asset existing in your possession and your ability to sell it, probably for a consumer good of some sort, that's a much better impulse because it's going to last. I do think, to some extent at least, the connection between wealth and the world in which you live is probably a good thing. You know, a great example is REITs versus actually owning houses in your neighborhood. Bitcoin's probably a better asset than doing either of those things. But if you own a REIT, you don't really care about its practices. If it's screwing over people in Maricopa County, you might, on a general level, dislike that, but you don't really care as long as the return's good and the dividend's good. You're too detached from it. Whereas if you look at, say, you own four rental homes 10 minutes from your house, same amount of money, same amount of income, there's a little bit more friction. But if you're dealing with the people in those homes, unless you're just cold-hearted, of the most cold-hearted of cold-hearted people, you know, if their kid gets sick and they have to miss half of rent for a month, you're probably not going to throw them out. Almost certainly you're not going to. And you'll probably care about them and, you know, follow up, see how the kid's doing, potentially try and help them. It's a completely different thing. It creates a different worldview. You're tied to the community and the people in it. Again, unless you're just cold-hearted. And you'll probably eventually get your money back. It's not going to be a huge deal. Whereas a large corporation is never going to do that. And particularly a shareholder of a large corporation isn't going to care. So it's just a very different perspective. And I think the connection of a large amount of wealth where you have the ability to afford some degree of noblesse oblige, at least, just creates better impulses in people and ends up leading to just a better back and forth between the rich and the poor, because they don't end up being quite as disconnected.
Yeah. Do you think we can get back to a culture built around these practices? It seems like we're pretty far away from this. Would you agree?
Yes. Yeah, I think one of the biggest, or the two biggest problems probably, are inflation and taxes. Like, for example, if you own an asset that produces a pretty steady amount of income and inflation is climbing up and 40% of it is being taxed away, you're going to be a bit harder edged and harder nosed with what happens, then if there aren't taxes and inflation is a problem, you're just probably going to be better set and it's not going to impact you as much. You're going to have a little bit more room to be nice and charitable. I just think it ends up creating, even if you're not intentional about it, a better mindset. So I think if you got rid of those two things, a lot of the bad impulses in private life would be ameliorated to some degree. The problem, though, is even if you got rid of that, you know, the idea of the gentleman has died out almost completely. Like if you read the Jane Austen books, just the worldview of the people in that world, from the day laborers to the dukes, was completely different because they understood social duties and social responsibilities back and forth, what they could expect from the world and what they're expected to do for it. I don't think you really have that now. Some people might. There's still a great number of great people out there who care about this stuff and do it and live by it. But you know, would Warren Buffett, you know, ever build, you know, better housing for laborers in, where does he live? Omaha?
Omaha.
Yeah, maybe. I don't really dislike Warren Buffett, but it's just not the same mindset. And no one ever taught him to live in a certain way. So I just think, you know, that sort of thing, you need a lot more propaganda, really, just about it and about why it's a good thing, and social education about why it's a good thing to get it back. So.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. How do we bring back the gentleman? I think chivalry is dead right now. We need to revive it. Do we need to like spin up cotillion in every in every state and every city around the country?
Yeah, I don't think it would have died, but for social conditions. Taxes and inflation are a big thing. The other thing is that a lot of this was meant for serving the state, whether it was like being nice to the people in your village, they wouldn't revolt and you didn't have to do the whole get on a horse and fight the peasant revolt thing on the like worst end of things, or just, you know, if your state's going to war and you're fighting the Sudanese or the Boers, you should sign up to be an officer because you're a privileged person. How well that all worked is a different question, but it was the impulse and they generally lived up to it. The Duke of Westminster, for example, was the wealthiest person of his day, and he was serving on horseback in the Boer War, somewhat ineffectively, but he was still doing his bit and being shot at. You know, that only happens when people see the state worth serving. Whereas if the state is constantly like putting out videos like those horrible, I don't know if you saw the military videos where it's like in the corporate cartoon style, and it's the air defense female officer talking about how her two moms taught her to like go to gay pride parades, and that's why she joined the Air Force.
Have you seen that?
It's insane. So when you do that, no one's gonna be like, well, I'm wealthy, so what I should really do is like go defend Baka Bazi in Afghanistan, so that like I'm kind of unclear what the army's doing in this thing. I'm not gonna do this. I'll just pass and, you know, live in the Caribbean or whatever. I the whole like just get out of society, or you really see it in I know I'm jumping all over the place, but the whole like move to the woods and be a subsistence farmer homestead movement is absurd and obscene. That's just a horrible decision for most people. At least you're not gonna be happy, and you're not gonna make any money. But the impulse behind it, I think, is people just want to get away from society because they see it as evil and irredeemable, and what people and the state are doing is just awful. So I think people with wealth do, on the whole, generally want to do good things with it, at least to some extent. Maybe not all the time, you know, like the prayer, Lord, make me no longer lustful, but maybe not tonight. I think that's really an impulse a lot of people have, but you're not going to get that if the state is evil and awful. So we talked earlier about restraining the state and giving people the ability to do cool things without just being this evil tyrannical force that's invading Iraq for no clear reason or bombing Libya for no clear reason. I do think you need a restrained state that acts on some degree of moral principle to get people to start acting like the gentleman officers of a century or two ago again, because people aren't going to do that if they just see what they're fighting for or serving in any degree, whether it's an administrator, an officer, a politician. They're not going to do it if they see it as evil or corrupt, and particularly if they're good people.
Yeah, that's why I'm optimistic. I mean, the policy, particularly on the tax side, that Trump is floating, high tariffs, no income tax, that would necessitate that you need to cut a large swath of the federal government, the administrative bureaucratic state, unless you want crazy inflation. If you want echo inflation like the 70s, you're going to do that and not cut any of the spending or the agencies within the federal government. And I think that naturally leads to the environment that you just described. You have all these busybodies in the federal government working at these agencies that are getting paychecks that are, I would argue, are not really deserved, but they feel empowered, and they just interrupt pure peer-to-peer economic activity and add friction. That does make it less appealing to want to go out and do things, where it's like, why am I going to try to deal with this fucking annoying agency? Excuse my language. And that's again, cautiously optimistic, preparing for the rug. But if you can thread this needle of bringing back tariffs, eliminating the income tax, and bringing in Ron Paul and Elon Musk to completely decimate the administrative state, like, I'm extremely optimistic for the future of American prosperity, quality of life, and hopefully a bridging of the gap of the social incohesion that exists right now.
Oh, yeah. It's hard to see if he's doing it intentionally, but really Trump in his rhetoric, particularly this time around, mirrors William McKinley to a great extent. McKinley famously, or perhaps less famously than deserved, came into office when labor relations with capital were at a nadir. There's the whole gold issue that we talked about a bit ago, and American industry was just being decimated by relatively free trade policies, and the government was getting ever bigger. McKinley dealt with a lot of that. The government probably got a little bit bigger because of the Spanish-American War, but he did put on tariffs, and there was no income tax, and the tariffs both funded the government and protected American industry, where you could get a good job as an American again. He was really good at handling labor and handling capital, so labor relations did very well, actually. He was great at handling both groups, and people kind of went back to there was less socialist bomb throwing than there had been a few years beforehand, and the owners of capital weren't just quite as intransigent. He got killed, but he did a good job. And Trump models himself, I think, off of McKinley, at least in his policies. And so I think if Trump brought it back, you'd see under Trump a return of what you saw under McKinley, which is American prosperity and just general positivity. And key to that, people miss this, but really key is the no income tax proposal. You know, when capital gains and dividends are taxed at a lower rate than income, that makes it impossible to ever catch up with the wealthy, no matter how well you do. You just can't, because they're taxed at a lower rate and their stuff grows at a higher rate. Whereas when there's no income tax, if you're intelligent or successful or just a person who's willing to go out and work hard and do things, you can make a good bit of money pretty quickly and just put it in assets that produce an income. And like we talked about a minute ago with the gentleman thing, enable you to serve. Almost no one serves when they're poor and will starve to death if they're not drawing a salary. They're going to demand their bureaucratic rights. They want a pension. They want an income. They want everything. Whereas when it's someone like Herbert Hoover, who never took a government salary, or anyone before him, British parliamentarians weren't paid until around 1900, maybe later even. It's a different type of person. And the people who are there, many of them just do it because they built wealth and are able to. But they wouldn't have built that wealth if it was taxed away with an income tax as they were trying to build their fortune. So it's just it creates a very, very different world. And I'm cautiously optimistic that it might happen, because it would be awesome if he gets even half of it done.
Yeah, it is insane when you go and understand the history of the income tax. Like, it was supposed to be a temporary 1% tax for, I think, like 2 years. And it's turned into this monstrosity that eats up half your income year in and year out. And then you're taxed. I mean, there's the famous, and I'm sure you've seen it, the TikTok video of the girl who's like, so let me get this straight. Like, I get paid and my company pays taxes on that money on the way in. I pay taxes as it comes to me. I go and spend it and I pay taxes on that. And the person receiving the money is paying taxes on the fact that they receive. Like, how does this work? And it is truly astonishing that we've gotten to this point in history where this has just been so normalized and people just expect this is the way the world works, when it really isn't and was never meant to. Again, it was supposed to be temporary. Like, 1913 is probably the worst year in U.S. history, in the sense that you had the Federal Reserve and the income tax both introduced into the American economy at the same time.
I'm not an economist, so take this with many grains of salt. But one of my personal pet theories is it's really hard to have sane interest rates and an income tax. Because if you have, say, 7% or whatever the natural rate of interest on money is, whether it's 5 or 7% or somewhere around there, it's really hard to do that and have an income tax, because you're not going to get any economic growth. People aren't going to have the money. You talked about the chain of every little which way it's taxed. So then by the time it gets to the people who would be reinvesting it in the economy, it's really hard for them to have enough to make a profit with like 7% rates. Whereas if you look at America before the income tax, American economic growth in real terms and real assets in the real world, instead of just all this phantom nonsense, was pretty solid, pretty steady, and it came with significant, I think, reasonable interest rates attached that made money real instead of just easy money. So I think if you want the sanity that is enforced by having rates around where they are now or a little higher, it's really, really, really hard to do that, I think, with an income tax that's just whittling things down as people try and reinvest it in the economy.
Yeah. And with the income tax and the debt, you're forced inevitably always to lower those interest rates down. I mean, now towards the zero bound, we're probably headed.
I should have finished the thought. That's what I was getting at and lost in my train of sorry. So you have to lower it to zero, which just creates all these just horrible things over time. All the ridiculous companies waste some money, et cetera.
You're literally ripping opportunity cost out of the economy, out of any economic decision. Rates are at zero, money's free. You don't have to think about weighing the consequences of allocating capital here as opposed to here. And you're just like, I'll do both, and it doesn't matter because it doesn't cost me anything. You literally need to introduce a natural rate of inflation that isn't corrupted because of the income tax or whatever it may be, the Federal Reserve, so that people are actually forced to make wise decisions from a capital allocation perspective. Or if I make this allocation and I don't make 5 to 7% back in income, hopefully more than that, so I can get a profit, then I'm fucked. 0% rates. You don't have that decision. So that's why you have this zombie economy filled with a bunch of useless widgets and tech products.
And if you think about all the zombie companies that have been kept around by the very low interest rates, there's just so much economic inefficiency and wasted capital and wasted human potential that result from that. Whether it's DEI inside companies that's just funded by money being cheap, or it's just companies sticking around that shouldn't be sticking around. I think you have a much better world that's more productive and more innovative when there's consequences attached to money and people actually have to do something with it, instead of it just being some carry trade where, well, the Fed says we can get money at a 1% rate, so we're going to use the money we loaned from the Fed or from BlackRock that's right attached to it to buy back our shares. And then when our shares go up because we bought them back, we'll just sell them again and pay the Fed back. And it's just, nothing happened there. It was a complete waste of money. It's just a waste. And there's a lot of inefficiency, and stuff that should get done isn't getting done because everything's financialized and they're just tinkering with it.
Yeah. Well, you keep saying you're not an economist, but I think you have a very good grasp on how all this stuff interacts with each other and how it affects us as a society. It's been fascinating. I love your work. I've been a lurker follower for some time now. I think the ideas that you're putting out there are very important. I think, like you said, we need to. That's one thing I think that Bitcoiners have honed in on, other people in different communities running in parallel tracks have really honed in on is learning how to control the propaganda and put our own propaganda out there to get these ideas out there. And I think you're doing a good job of that.
Thank you.
And we need to really embrace that. That's another terrible thing of the last 50 years, is the definition of propaganda, or the understanding of the word propaganda by the masses, has been completely corrupted. It is something that everybody's like, oh, propaganda's bad. It's like, yes, there's certainly bad propaganda, but propaganda is a means by which you affect change by getting your ideas out there and making convincing arguments via via effective propaganda.
And that's, the worst regimes used it, but that doesn't mean that virtue wasn't inculcated by it. Like, how much of the British Empire would have existed if they hadn't been describing how it was generally a force for good in the world, whether it was ridding it of slavery or spreading just civilization and Western medicine to these places? It probably wouldn't have happened without propaganda. I think, like you said, people misunderstand the term and where it's useful.
Yeah, we need better propaganda out there. Thank you for putting it out there. Will, this has been a pleasure. Anything, any final thoughts about anything we talked about before we wrap up here?
This was great. I think Bitcoin's definitely a very new world thing, a new economy thing, but I think there's a lot that people who have gotten wealthy through it, who are planning to get wealthy through it, should learn about the old world, because what do we do this if not for our children? Yeah. That's the point.
Tradition isn't a bad thing. It's essential to actually survival and making sure that we live in a world that is worth living in the future.
Exactly.
All right. That's all we got today, freaks. Peace and love. Okay.